couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, West Side Story, Being the Ricardos, National Champions, The Unforgivable, and Don't Look Up. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the original 1947 version of Nightmare Alley. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
We're fully into award season right now, and a lot of the focus of the movie scheduling and the releases, that's all based on awards push for the current films. And it, largely after Thanksgiving, movie and television production shut down until the new year. But of course, the focus on the awards campaigning is actively happening. But there was a real interesting thing that hit the news that I thought was a hilarious story. And I was actually present during all of this. The movie Don't Look Up, which is coming out this week in limited release, and it'll be dropping on Netflix later in December, I think on the 24th. There was an event in New York City, and I was at this one, where they had a press conference for this movie. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, Jonah Hill, directed by Adam McKay. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go to this press conference. And then this little bit happened that ended up being talked about a lot on all the late shows like The Tonight Show, and Jennifer Lawrence talked about on Stephen Colbert. If you're not aware of this, Jonah Hill has a little bit of a reputation for derailing press conferences because he's a little bit wacky. He gets into comedy. He talks absurdist things. And of course you had Adam McKay as the director, and he's got a background in improv. So the two of them during this press conference, they start riffing on stuff like the inspiration they drew for this movie, Don't Look Up, from things like Iron Eagle 2 and Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakquel, which was very funny to watch them just kind of derail and go off onto their own little tangents with this. But at one point, Jonah Hill talks about how he adored working with Meryl Streep, because Meryl Streep plays the president in this movie, and he plays her son, who's also her chief of staff. And they had a lot of scenes together, and so they had this relationship, and he was calling her, oh my God, Meryl, you're the goat, you're awesome. And of course, a lot of people know internet slang, the GOAT means greatest of all time. You know, it's an acronym. It's a millennial term. Well, apparently, earlier that day, while they were doing a photo shoot before this press conference, Meryl was mentioning that to Jennifer Lawrence and had said, well, you know, he would call me the old GOAT, and Jennifer's like, hold on a second. You do know that GOAT is an acronym for greatest of all time. Now, Meryl, being a woman in her 70s, had no idea. Because, it was like saying that to my mother. I was telling this story to my mom, and my mom didn't know what a goat meant. I mean, she knew what a farm animal was. And in the middle of the press conference, I'm watching this thing unfold. Jonah Hill is visibly shook. I mean, he is floored, because it was at that moment he realized that he had been calling Meryl Streep the GOAT for months. And only in this moment did he realize she didn't know what he was talking about. She thought that he was calling her an old GOAT, because she was like, well, that's what my mom referred to herself as, an old GOAT. And the funniest part about this is Meryl thought it was like a deprecating insult, but she was okay with it, which I guess speaks to her character, because she's, I think, getting insulted, but she's okay without realizing it's a huge compliment. And I'm sitting here watching this unfold, and there's Jonah Hill melting into his chair, because he just realized he'd been calling his idol something and she didn't know what it meant. And they ended up talking about this on the late night shows, which was really funny, because I'm like, hey, I was there when that press conference happened. So this is sort of the background of when you see movies made. I don't want to be the one to say that a movie is better when the people had fun making it. Because if that were the case, like Smoking the Bandit 2 would be the greatest movie of all time, and it's clearly not. But in making Don't Look Up, you could tell that there was a lot of familiarity. I mean, you watch press conference and interaction between actors, and you can see sometimes they're very serious, and sometimes they're taking their craft serious, and sometimes there's conflicts on set, and you can see how some person might be a little bit cold during a press conference and not like doing the promotional stuff. But you see something like this, and apparently they had a blast making this movie. We'll talk about the film later, but it was this really fun moment that I felt blessed to be able to tap into, because I was able to watch this unfold in real time before my eyes as it becomes this quirky little news story that kind of took over the marketing of the film this week. So that was really kind of fun. But yeah, the interaction between all the people at the press conference really showed that there was an energy behind the movie, and we'll talk about it when we talk a little bit more about the movie itself. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is for a TV series. It's coming to HBO Max on January 13th. It's called Peacemaker.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Peacemaker?
No.
He is a trained killer. We've got trouble with that maniac.
I thought you were in prison for life.
I work for the government.
Post office?
You think they'd let me out of prison to deliver mail?
I don't know. It's the first government job I could think of.
I kill people for them, okay?
This task force doesn't officially exist.
He told me to kill kids. He didn't say why.
I thought you loved peace, no matter how many men, women, and children you needed to kill to get it.
This is, of course, based on the John Cena character in The Suicide Squad. If you remember watching The Suicide Squad, if you did see that, they left a little bit of an open-ended story for him, and it's because they're doing a spinoff series on HBO Max, which it's got James Gunn behind it as well. It doesn't look like it's as big of a budgeted type thing, but it still has John Cena in that role playing the Peacemaker with that absurd helmet he's wearing. And yes, there looks like there's plenty of shots of him running around in his tidy whities. I love John Cena as an actor because he is very game to do this. And it looks like they're taking what's ostensibly a much darker character from the movie, trying to give him a little bit of depth, because in the trailer, he's questioning whether or not it's necessary to kill any man, woman, or child in the name of peace. So this is going to be a fine line to walk about giving him too much depth as a character and still allowing him to be that absurd archetype. But I have faith in James Gunn, and I have faith in John Cena's performance that this might actually be a really fun movie and one of the more popular things that comes out of The Suicide Squad. Like I said, that drops on January 13th on HBO Max. The next trailer I want to talk about is for Operation Fortune, which is the new Guy Ritchie movie, which comes to theaters next month, January 21st.
So what we got? Something rather nasty has been stolen. We have to stop that getting onto the open market.
Who's the buyer?
Greg Simmons.
The billionaire arms dealer.
Ooh, a lot of very serious faces up here, aren't there?
You can't catch this fish with conventional lures.
I'm sorry?
The lure being?
Danny Francesco. The movie star.
Greg Simmons' favorite movie star.
And how do we get him?
Blackmail.
Who's to care? Very good. Carry on.
Honestly, one of the biggest reasons I'm interested in this movie is because Aubrey Plaza's in there to mix it up with Jason Statham. I think that they're going to have great chemistry because both of them have this kind of deadpan delivery, but in a very different way. So I'm looking to watch this interaction. It looks like it's one of those broad action comedies that Guy Ritchie's kind of known for. And you've got the action, but you've also got absurd, silly, fun things going on with a great cast, a bunch of people he's worked with before, not just Jason Statham, but people like Hugh Grant, who I believe was in the Gentleman. So this one looks kind of fun. I thought his Wrath of Man movie was okay this past year. This one looks like it's going to be classic Guy Ritchie, tongue-in-cheek action but comedy. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about being the Ricardos and national champions.
Yeah.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Being the Ricardos. Aaron Sorkin writes and directs this week in the life of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, during which Lucy is facing a publicity kerfuffle for declaring herself a communist on a voter registration decades before.
I am the biggest asset in the portfolio of the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Roll sound.
Let's do our show.
I get paid a fortune to do exactly what I love doing.
They got their money's worth.
Pictures up.
You know, I did this show so Desi and I could be together.
Ladies and gentlemen, enjoy the show.
And action.
I had no idea it was going to be a hit.
This isn't exactly a biopic, and it's currently in limited release, and it's going to be coming to Amazon Prime at the streaming service, I believe, on December 21st. It's not exactly a biopic because it doesn't give an overall view of Lucille Ball or Desi Arnaz's life. It's more, like I said, it's a week in the life. It's while they're developing the show and producing I Love Lucy, and it's kind of pulling the veil back on what went on in the production and how she was involved in the writing and the staging and the directing, and how also TV was still in its infancy. It was still trying to figure out what it was. So stuff that is very basic in TV now, that sort of this language and setup of like a multi-camera sitcom, they were still figuring that stuff out in the 50s. So it was a relatively new medium, and it shows her meddling's the wrong word, but her inserting herself in her comedy into the production and how critical Lucille Ball was to developing this, and how the two of them, Lucy and Desi, did kind of run the power play on the studio and on the sponsor. You've got Nicole Kidman as Lucille Ball, and people pointed out she doesn't quite look like her, and that's true. I think they do some makeup and prosthetics, which makes her look a little bit freaky. You get used to it after a little bit in the film, but she looks kind of strange. But then again, you get that all the time with Nicole Kidman. She's had some work done. But also, Javier Bardem doesn't look anything like Desi Arnaz. I mean, Javier Bardem has this very rough face, whereas Desi Arnaz had a very boyish face. So this is less about getting an exact duplicate of these characters and having actors perform them, and you can kind of get into the show itself. The strengths of this movie is the behind-the-scenes look at it, but also how Lucy interacted with Vivian Vance and the other co-stars, and the power structure in the studio and the writers and the directors of the show, and how she would sometimes wrestle control out of it. And obviously in this one, it's showing her smartly doing it. I'm sure that there was some butting of the heads, and you get that a lot in TV where people are trying to take control of something, and making just something as whimsical as I Love Lucy still had some real contention behind the scenes and how they were developing it. But at the same time, you're looking at them wanting to know what's going to happen when they get pregnant again and how they present that on television, because that was a big deal back then. You didn't say the word pregnant back then. You weren't allowed to. And it's a good performance by both Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem. And also the supporting cast is quite good. It being an Aaron Sorkin film, you do have the intricate dialogue, but you don't have the rapid fire of the dialogue that you oftentimes do. Something like The Trial of the Chicago 7 from last year, which Sorkin wrote and directed, is a far better movie than this one. This is still a good movie. And if you're a big fan of Lucille Ball and her television legacy, you are absolutely going to walk away with a good view of this movie. That being said, because it's a type of biopic, it falls into the traps of a biopic, where you have to take some artistic liberties. You have to massage events and follow them around, and you got to make it more dramatic from a presentation standpoint. Because I've always said life has a great sense of drama, but it does not always have a great sense of timing. And so it does feel compressed at times, and it does kind of fall into tropes of just what people do in their lives that could be interpreted as cliches, but even though they're true elements, you know, people are predictable. And that's one of the biggest challenges of overcoming with a biopic. But still, it's an interesting movie, and it's a nice pulling of the veil back on what happened in the Desilu production company and how Lucille Ball galvanized herself as a television icon. So I'm going to say Being the Ricardos kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about national champions. A university football phenom leads a boycott against the NCAA in order to secure payment and benefits for student athletes who get no compensation from the lucrative world of college sports.
Wolves quarterback LaMarcus James should be the best quarterback to come into the NFL since Patrick Mahomes.
This is the home of my best friend and teammate, Emmitt Sunday. Tomorrow he'll play in a game that will gross over $500 million. But Emmitt won't see a dime. And just like the other 12,000 draft-eligible players that don't make the NFL every year, his football days will be over. So join me in this boycott to demand that the NCAA will recognize players as paid employees and not student-athletes.
Four players just tweeted, "We're in," with the hashtag fix the system.
The whole point of the movie is to shine a light on the fact that students in college playing football, they don't get compensated at all. They may get a free education out of it, and that's obviously certainly worth something. But they don't get access to healthcare outside of the college system. You know, a lot of players don't make it to the pros, let alone become a star. And they sometimes come out of college with injuries, and they're basically put through the meat grinder, but they get no benefit from it. At the same time, the coaches and the NCAA and the sponsors, it's big business. People walking around with salaries in the millions of dollars who are profiting from this. If you're able to be the phenom who signs on for a $35 million contract with an NFL team, you're going to do fine for yourself. But if you're just some tight end who isn't good enough to make it in the pros, you may have squandered your ability to play. And I think that's a good issue to look at, whether there should be some sort of compensation or some sort of structure to help out the student athletes, and does it fall into almost unpaid labor to a degree. But the movie is so poorly put together, it's a terrible film. The pacing is bad. It has these long extended scenes of people just moping around in hotel rooms, having under their breath conversations. I was like 20 minutes into this movie. I'm like, what the heck's happening here? The delivery of the lines are terrible. And while they got some good performers, J.K. Simmons, who's also in Being the Ricardos, weirdly enough, he plays one of the coaches, and they just don't flesh out the characters. And they have sort of like this background sort of soap opera stuff happening with one of the coach's wives. And it's excruciating to watch. And then when you finally get to the part where they're going to try and do this boycott, you're like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, no, we're still back with somebody moping around in a hotel room. And what? There's some interesting stuff that goes on, but I struggled to even stay awake during this thing. The movie itself is so flaccidly put together. It takes a very interesting subject matter that should have a spotlight on it, and it can't even focus that spotlight. This movie is terrible. I did not like this movie at all, even though I think its heart's in the right place. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to say it totally sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about West Side Story and The Unforgivable.
Y'all ready for this?
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about West Side Story. Steven Spielberg reimagines the classic Broadway musical about star-crossed lovers in the middle of a gang turf war in the 1950s.
This is my first time in New York City. I want to be happy here. I want to make a life, a home.
The first gringo boy who smiles at you.
I never seen you before. You're not Puerto Rican.
Is that okay?
You keep away from him. As long as you're in my house,
I'm a grown-up now, Bernardo. I'm gonna think for myself.
It's the 60 years. Do you realize it's been 60 years since the original movie came out in 1961? And, of course, the stage play was, what, 1957, late 50s? And this was, I think, supposed to come out a while ago, but, of course, got delayed by the pandemic, and it's now getting its big release in theaters. Steven Spielberg's not known for doing musicals, so this is a little bit of a diversion from what he normally does, and that's great, because he's still one of the master directors of our time, and he's quite brilliant in what he does, but it's also him doing something a little bit different. One of the most refreshing things about this is it's nice to see a musical that has nothing to do with Lin-Manuel Miranda, because, of course, he had done In the Heights, and he had done Hamilton last year, and then he had even, like, other things. Like, he does the music in Encanto and in Vivo, and he's involved in Tick, Tick, Boom. So there's so much of Lin-Manuel Miranda in the musical world that it's almost like it's impossible to escape him. And here comes this vintage production that has nothing to do with him, and there's something refreshing about the songs, partly because, you know, I recognize a lot of them. And that's one of the strengths of West Side Story. It's such an indelible movie. It's so well known that when you watch it around every corner, you're like, oh, that song, I know that song. And oh my gosh, oh, I forgot that song's in the movie. Oh yeah, that's great. And it's probably been about 10 years since I watched the movie, the original West Side Story. So I recognize stuff, but I don't know every single beat of the production. I've heard that they make some changes. I think they shuffle around some of the songs, and there's one moment that has a really jarring placement of a song, so it's not like a perfect construction. And like any musical, it does run a little bit long. And the reason for that is when you have a Broadway production, you know, it's going to be several hours long. If you blow $200 on a ticket and it's only 90 minutes, you're going to feel ripped off. But a movie, once it starts clocking over 2 hours and 10 minutes or so, people are like, you better have a good reason to be 2.5 hours long. So this one does kind of take a little longer than it could. I think they could have dropped some parts in it. But that's okay. I mean, it still flows incredibly well. And one of the things Spielberg does with this movie is he makes it take place in the time in which it was written. So he doesn't update it to 2020. He still has it takes place in the late 1950s, but he also shoots it in such a way, and they do production design that while it has a crisp contemporary look, it still looks like you could have pulled this right out of the late 1950s, 1960s. There are some parts of it that they do some digital stuff in the background or some effects. You can tell they're doing some digital trickery in there, but there's a lot of stuff in there that it looks like it could have been shot in 1961 as well. So it has that look, and even just the way he casts it and assembles the people in the background, it looks very authentically of its time. Additionally, it's a beautiful looking movie. It has some very vibrant, wide shots of choreography, and which are very different, especially coming out, you know, what was it, 8 months or something like that, when In the Heights came out 6 or 8 months ago. And although they're very different movies, they both have these big show-stopping dance numbers in the streets of New York City. So it differentiates. It does not look like those movies actually came out in the same year. It has a unique look. Like the whole America sequence, the song America, has a great dance number, and it's a real showstopper, but it doesn't feel like it's riffing off of, no pun intended, riffing off of any other movie. It looks like it's doing an authentic version of it. And it's really well done, and it doesn't reek of Spielberg. You know, Spielberg has all these long staring shots in his movies, and there are certain tropes that he does that as an auteur you recognize as a Spielberg thing. But this doesn't look like a Spielberg movie because he doesn't do a whole lot of musical, and I think that's a testament to him. So ultimately, this is a very well done movie. I think it's going to connect a lot to fans of the original show, but if you've never seen it, it's still a great way to do it. In terms of the cast, the girl who plays Maria, she's good. Her voice a little overly operatic for me in terms of style. But you've got Ansel Elgort. At his most, Ansel Elgorty in this movie. I would have picked somebody else. I don't think he's the strongest Tony. But the rest of the cast, who's a lot of people you don't know their names, like the guy who plays Bernardo and the guy who plays Riff, they really pop in the movie, and it works. This movie is, it's exactly what you'd want from something like this, not trying to ape the original, but actually being its own unique version of West Side Story. So I'm going to say West Side Story totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Unforgivable. Sandra Bullock plays a woman released from prison after 20 years for murder who wants to track down her younger sister.
I was in prison. I just got out.
Your house after 20 years.
For what? It was an accident.
Does your release alter the terms of your no-contact order?
You don't have to give me a speech. I'm looking for Katie. She's my little sister. I raised her. Okay, next time, don't drag me through 3 bus transfers to tell me something you already know.
This dropped on Netflix, I believe, midweek. I think it was a Wednesday drop. And it's the latest in a whole slew of films coming out on Netflix that feature big-name movie stars. And it's interesting with Sandra Bullock because she did Bird Box several years ago, and that was extremely popular and a big hit for Netflix. And it was that was one of the first big movies with actual movie stars in it that was starting to put Netflix on the map. And so Sandra Bullock's coming back for another movie. This one is based on a book, and it's about this woman who's been in prison and she's being released, but she's court ordered to not get in touch with her family or the people involved in the situation that happened, either the victims or even her sister who she wants to have a relationship with, but she's barred from that. But of course she wants to try and make that connection, and it's her trying to navigate the system. And it's showing how depressing it can be to be on parole and to have to jump through the hoops as a parolee. And I mean, she does a fine job acting, but man, this is one of those really heavy, dour stories. It's also overly contrived. That's the biggest struggle I have with movies like this, because it has all this stuff that it hinges upon what really happened, what happened, what got her in jail. And they just do this gymnastics to avoid showing you what really happened, or even just avoid showing you what she was charged with. It's all about, it's in flashback. And at times you're just like, oh my God, you're spending too much time purposely not revealing what had happened, and you're leaving stuff to our assumptions. And whenever you have twists or turns in the plot for a movie like this, if you've been purposely obfuscating them, it becomes more about those mental gymnastics to do that than it is about telling an authentic story. And it's trying to tell the story of this woman and to give a real human experience. But all the same, you're purposely hiding all these elements of the background, and it becomes distracting from that story. Just tell the authentic story or give the background, but you kind of can't do both and then throw in weird twists. It feels like it's poorly written, and I think the original book probably has a different punch to it, but this was rough. It's not terrible, but it's not a great movie, so I'm gonna have to say The Unforgivable kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Okay, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm gonna be talking about Don't Look Up and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring 1947's Nightmare Alley. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with the movie reviews and talk about Don't Look Up. Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence play scientists who discover a comet on a collision course with Earth, struggling to get politicians, the media, and the average citizen to take the threat seriously.
Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
This is the worst news in the history of humanity.
He just blew us off.
We have to release the information.
So we just leak it.
How big is this thing going? I can't destroy my ex-wife's house. Is that possible?
There's a 100% chance that we're all going to die.
This is in theaters right now in limited release, but you can also wait until, I believe it's on December 24th, it's going to drop on Netflix. So that's in about 2 weeks. This is a big deal of a movie, mainly because it has such a huge cast. It's directed by Adam McKay, and he is well known for doing stuff like, I think he did the original Anchorman and Step Brothers. So he's used to doing the broad comedies, but recently he's been doing movies that are a little more topical. Like he did The Big Short. He did the movie Vice. This is also about something topical, but it's an allegory to it. And it was originally conceived as the comet coming to hit the Earth as this impending crisis was an allegory for environmental issues, particularly climate change and that sort of thing. It's more of a call for, hey, listen to the scientists, not the politicians on this sort of thing. When they made the movie, they came up with the idea and they wrote the script prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. But they were producing it and making the movie during the pandemic. And in a strange way, the world started to mimic the movie. So even though it's not about a pandemic, things are happening where things are getting politicized that should have no political basis. They are people trying to mitigate and argue with the math of whether or not the comet's going to hit. And there's some great moments where they're trying to convince the president, played by Meryl Streep, that this is happening, and it's like 99 point whatever percent, because nothing in science is 100%. And they're like, well, let's just call it 70%. And they're like, no, that's not, it's way more than 70%. And it shows how people's different interests affect this and how hard it is to explain it, because the whole point is the characters played by both Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, they want them to go on TV and explain it, but they're like, stay away from the math. And at one point he says, well, it's all math, because that's the way planetary bodies work. And some of it is absurd, but other, you know, if this were made 3 years ago, you would have thought it was overly absurd, but it's not. And we get these end of the world movies every 10 or 12 years. You know, about 10 or 12 years ago, we had like Melancholia and Seeking a Friend for the End of the World in 2012. And then about 10 years before that, we had stuff like Armageddon and Deep Impact. But this one is very specifically a satire of the media and politics. Even when you're telling somebody on some coffee klatch TV show, they don't want to know about, let's not make it too depressing. It's like, no, a comet's going to come and kill everybody. It's an extinction level event, but people want to put their heads down. That's what the whole don't look up is about. There starts to become a political slogan to not even bother to look up. And the movie itself is biting satire. The biggest struggle when you start watching this movie is trying to figure out its tone, because it has this very depressing presence to it, but the satire is meant to be very realistic. So it presents it almost in a dramatic situation, but the people's reaction are so over the top that it becomes a comedy. And what I found so fascinating about this movie was the fact that it was made during COVID, and some of the same nonsense you see in this movie that seems like it'd be over the top is actually very real discussions that you hear in the real world. Like, one of the biggest problems with COVID is it was science happening in real time, and science is messy. Science is not perfect. Science is getting data and reacting. And when you, at the beginning of getting data, you're going to get certain things wrong, and it's the best guess. That's how science works. And that allowed it to be overly politicized and, you know, data to be suppressed and changed or whatever. I mean, there's a whole section in this film where it criticizes the removing of scientists from a project because they don't like the information they're getting when they're getting it peer reviewed, which is very important in science. Peer review is extremely important in science. And when you start removing that process because it's not giving you the right results you want, that can have devastating effects. So the movie itself really does walk that tightrope between disaster film and broad allegory satire. I think it works extremely well. Like I said, it's very hard to kind of get into the groove of the tone, but once you get the groove of the tone, it's actually quite brilliant. This is the level of filmmaking that I think Adam McKay excels at. That's why I like the Big Short. He took something very complex and he made it very digestible, and also entertaining and funny. And I think you're getting that with this movie as well. So it's a great movie. It's very funny and both hilarious and depressing at the same time. So I'm going to say Don't Look Up totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on the original Nightmare Alley. Nightmare Alley is being remade this year. It comes out next week. It's directed by Guillermo del Toro. So I thought I'd go in and look at the original film from 1947. A carnival worker stumbles upon a method of performing mentalism, which he uses to gain great fame, but gets caught up in a larger scandal.
I wonder why I'm like that.
Like what?
I'm never thinking about anybody except myself.
Well, you don't think I'd go without you?
You mean that, Stan?
You're not a regular MD, are you?
Of course not. But anything my patients reveal to me is as sacred as though it were given under the seal of the confessional. That clear?
All right, all right. You don't have to get on a soapbox. I'm going to be strictly on the level about this whole thing myself.
Will you get out of here? I should have known you were that kind of a...
It takes one to catch one.
Now, just for the record, it's actually kind of hard to find the original Nightmare Alley. You can find it on DVD and Blu-ray. You can go buy it. I believe it had a Criterion Blu-ray release. You know, which you can pick up for $20. It's worth seeing because it's a classic production. The production is based on a book, and in 1947, it's contemporary because I think it might take place in the earlier 40s or maybe even the 30s. A lot of people focus on Tyrone Power's performance in this movie, and he was trying to break his typecasting and his mold. And I'm not terribly familiar with Tyrone Power's. But he works as that lead, and it shows the rise and fall of somebody in their fame. The strongest parts of this version of Nightmare Alley are in the carnival setting, which I guess kind of jacked up the budget because they built this whole carnival. They didn't limit it too much. And it shows the life of a carny and a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. It has a subplot with a geek. If you know what a geek was, it was a guy who literally ate live animals for stage and how geeks were considered kind of a fringe thing and reputable carnivals didn't have them. But it shows that sort of unregulated version of the carnival atmosphere, especially back in the earlier part of the 20th century. So that's pulling the veil back and looking at the rough and tumble life of somebody in a carnival, why somebody wouldn't want to break through, and the fact that this character, even though he can make it into high society, at his heart, he is still a con man in a lot of ways. So it has these interesting twists and turns. Like I said, the high society stuff is interesting, but I mean, and it's critical to the movie, but I prefer the bookends of the carnival element to it. I think that they do a lot with the acting, particularly Tyrone Powers, leading the film does absolutely work. So it deals with some unpleasant things, and even the ending, I think they make some changes to the ending compared to the book, which I believe probably had more to do with not violating the Hays Code than anything. But it's an interesting movie. It's worth seeing, and it's worth seeing as a companion piece to the new Nightmare Alley, although depending on which one you want to be the original pure experience, because they follow very similar stories. If you watch this one first, you're going to know what happens in the new one. But it's absolutely worth checking out. Nightmare Alley from 1947 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week on DVD and Blu-ray, we have Cry Macho and Werewolves Within. Then there's vintage titles of The Karate Kid, the 3-movie collection. One Night in Miami, which was an award film from last year, gets a Criterion release. Krampus for Christmas gets a 4K release. And finally on TV, Rick and Morty Season 5 and Creepshow Season 2 are available. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man No Way Home, the new Nightmare Alley, and the Tender Bar. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.